Shlach. Parsha Shlach goes through a number of issues, but is mostly dominated by the story of the Meraglim, and by exactly what happened and the breakdown of what happened with the story of the spies. And we'll see that they weren't really spies. Now the end of that's most the beginning of Shlach. That's what we're going to come back to. That's the setting up of the spies, the entering into Israel, the coming back, the reporting. At the end of Shlach, finally, at the way end, we have the mitzvah of Challah, a very important mitzvah, the mitzvah of, especially today, Afrashas Challah, and of course, the parsha of towards the end of Tzitzis, the final parsha of Tzitzis. But we're going to focus today. Just on the story of the spies, right? The story of the Meraglim. So let's go for a second, and we all know the story, right? We're going to look at the psukim in a second, but the story is that these people were sent. They were sent to check out the land. They were not. We'll see. They don't seem to be sent to spy out the land, because it never says the word miragel. It doesn't say the word spy. And somehow, when they came back, they decided to really have a unique perspective, and maybe they took things into their own hands. And then they get punished with another 38 years. So this story really lends us to ask a number of questions, which we read the psukim and then we ask the questions. But let's just ask the questions because we know this story since we were kids. So the questions are, number one, what was so terrible? Why did they go? What was so terrible about their sin? What did they do so wrong that God says you need another 38 years? And as we saw last week in Baloscha, already the Jews, the armor is already cracking a little bit. They seem to not be prepared and ready and mature enough, in a certain sense, to enter into Israel. And then it seems that they do tshuva, and it doesn't really work. So first, let's discuss what exactly went wrong with the Meraglim. So the Psukim tell us the following. The Psukim tell us, Vaydaber Hashem Moshe lemer shlach lecha anashim, v'yasuru es eretz Kenan. The word v'yasuru, here it's translated as scout out, or check it out. It doesn't mean to spy. Okay? Jews are not, probably if you wanted to spy, you're not going to send one person from each tribe. You're not going to send the most well-known of all of those people to spy. Otherwise, you'd just be a very, very bad spy. You'd get caught right away. So send these people, okay? Each tribe is going to send one representative. Vayishlach Pasuk Gimel tells us, Kulam Anashim, Roshei B'nei Yisrael Hema. They were not just people, they were righteous people, they were leaders, which lends us even to really be bothered by what's happening. If something so terrible as the report is going to come to say, oh my gosh, we can't go, it's impossible, then why in the world are these Roshei B'nei Yisrael Hema? If there was a Siyum HaShas in the times of the Midbar, these people, they're getting the real seats, okay? They're not getting the seats high up. I'm not saying anything against my father-in-law and the seats that we had for the Siyum HaShas, but I'm saying they weren't the seats on the dais, okay? They weren't dais-level seats, okay? These are Roshei B'nei Yisrael Hema. Then the Psukim continues, it gives us the list of each of these people. Each of the tribes sent a representative to go ahead. Fine. Let's go ahead to Pasuk Tes. These are very important psukim to read through as we sort of build what's happening with the Jewish people. Let's remember, they don't know yet that it's 38 more years. They are ready. Even though the anticipation, the excitement, and the energy was in last week's parsha, they still think we're going in tomorrow. So the Pasuk says, Elish Shemos on Hashem Shalach Moshe Lasor Esaaretz. These are the people. Vayikach Moshe Yehoshua Ben Nun Yehoshua. And here they change his name. Right, Moshe changes his name. We'll see in a second why, but he changes his name to Yehoshua. Fine. Vayishlach Osam Moshe Lasor Esaaretz Kenan. Vayomar Aleim Aluzeba Negev Alisem Esahar. Here's exactly the way you're gonna go. And then Moshe Rabbeinu, understanding that perhaps there might be some negativity built in to what they're going to do, gives them a checklist. I don't want you to pretend you know what you're doing. Here's exactly what you are going to do. You're going to take this little clipboard, right? You're going to take this little clipboard. I'll give you, for those that, so some good information. For those that know Rabbi Brand, okay? So, Michael, this could be good for you at a board meeting. So when we were in camp together, Rabbi Brand 1 year was like the head of like Kolor or whatever he was the head of. And he really liked his clipboard. He was very into his clipboard. So we decided, and even though he was only a year older than me, but he was at that point, obviously, you know, the next stage of counseling. So we got his clipboard wet. And it was a very, very sad day for us because he was not very happy with us. But these guys, they have a clipboard. And on their clipboard is exactly the answers they're supposed to find. The pasuk says, Urisem esa'aretz mahi, pasuk yurches. See what the land is. Ha'am ayoshev aleha. Look at the people. Ha'chazaku ha'rafeh ha'ma'atu emrav. Answer these questions. Look at the land. Umaha'aretz. What kind of land is it? What about the cities? Are they fortified? Is it fertile? Can we plant there? And he tells them, bring back some fruits. Vayalu, Pasuk tells us, Vayasuru esa'aretz. So he takes them and he tells them exactly where to go, what to do, what to answer, the questions, exactly everything perfect. Now, let's take a step back. Why is Moshe Rabbeinu sending these people? Why is Moshe Rabbeinu sending them? This does not seem to be a mission of spying. This seems to be conquest. We're going to have to obviously take over the land, right? We're going to have to conquer it. We know that already. And we're going to have to set up our homeland. So therefore tell us how the people are situated. How are we going to win? If we take a step back, we realize this was a fact-finding mission, not just for the military purposes. There's 2 million of us entering into Israel. All right? So we have to figure out. There's nothing wrong, even though God didn't tell them this. He wants them to go in. But they say, listen, we're going to go in. We want to know what we're getting ourselves into. So it makes sense? Therefore, who did they pick from each tribe? Of course they didn't pick some schmo who has no idea what's happening. They picked the leader of each shevet. They picked a person who could come back and each tribe would listen to Shevet Reuven, Shevet Levi. They would say, fine, we trust you. Now we're ready to go. And imagine if this was successful, the Jews are nervous. They're going to fight battles. They're going to do all of these things. But if it comes back and it's positive, you've just united everyone together. There's this great TED talk by Derek Silvers. Derek Silvers is a musician. He's an entrepreneur. And he shows this, it's a very short clip, but he shows this video of a guy, you know, in the old days when people used to congregate together, like on grass fields. So he sees this group of people. They're watching some, whatever it was, a game, something. Some guy gets up and he just starts dancing wildly. Everybody's looking at him like it's weird. And then finally some other guy comes in and starts dancing wildly with him. Before you know it, everyone's dancing wildly. And he says, who's the leader? He says, the leader is not the first guy that does it because he's just a wacko. The leader is the second guy that does it that now brought everybody else in together. The goal was, you go, one of you, come back and bring us all in, really buy us into what we're about to do. And obviously, we can see already that it doesn't seem so great in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that maybe we want this. But nonetheless, whoops, hold on a second. Nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, we're going to go ahead. We're going to send them in. So now look what happens when they come back. So sure was Moshe Rabbeinu that this would go positively that the following is told of us. The pasuk says, Chavav, Vayelchu Vayavo Amoshe V'Al Aaron. They come back here in Pasuk Chavav. They come back. The El Kol Adas B'nei Yisrael. Not only did Moshe Rabbeinu come to hear what happened, they brought everyone. It was an assembly, required mandatory assembly. Come hear what they have to say. So they come back and they bring with them as priyaretz. Vayisapru lo vayomru banu elo aretz asher shalach tanu. I mean, shalach tanu. you sent us, and we v'gam zavas chalav udvash. Ah, what a land! What a land! Exactly as we were told. You know, there's an interesting halacha that you know, you're not allowed to eat. The halacha tells us that kolayotze mina aser aser, whatever comes out of a non-kosher animal, you can't eat. So a dead animal is fine because that's not aser anymore if it's shechted properly. But a live animal is eiver min achai. You can't eat that. It's one of the sheva mitzvos b'nei Noach. Can't eat a live animal. So the shaila is, how could you ever have milk? How could you ever have milk? Milk comes from a live animal. Live animal is aser. Kol hayotze min aser aser. It's a good question. Don't worry. The answer is, because the pasuk says it's zavas chalav udvash. Of course you'd be able to have milk. It's such a, that's how we describe Israel. So they come back and they say, ah, it's a great land. And I just want to go through the whole story, and then we're going to peel it back a little bit. And then they say a word you should never say in any type of discussion with anybody you care about or in an interview. You say, Ephes, but. So you negated everything else you just said. Ki az ha'am ayoshev ba'aretz, ve'arim mitzulos gidolos ma'od ve'gam yilide ha'anak ra'inu sham. Oh my gosh. They are so fortified. They're huge. There's giants. There's giants there. Amalek, Yoshev Eretz HaNegev. You have Amalek. Then you have the Chiti and the Yavusi and the Amori, Bahar, and the Knanim or Yoshev El Hayam. It's like the 6 day war. Oh my gosh. From every angle, someone is about to attack us. So now Kalev comes in. And Kalev, Vayas, Kalev, Elohim, Kalev silences them. And Kalev says, Alo na'aleh, the Arashtim, so we'll come back to this in a minute, what exactly Kalev is saying. Ki achonu chalo, we could do it. Pasuk Lamed Aleph tells us, Va'anashim esha alo imo, these great, righteous people say, Lo nuchal la'alos, Elohim, ki chaza kumimeno, there is no way we can do it. And we'll come back to this all the way at the end. Vayotze dibas ha'aretz asher taruosa. They spoke bad about the land of Israel, and they said, it's an eretz ocheles yoshvehoi. So the question is, what in the world just happened? What in the world just happened? So angry is God that God essentially says, I'm done. I'm not going to keep this up. I'm not going to take you in. Why would I want to keep doing this? And he punishes them. They cry that night. What are we doing? We're going to die here. We should go back to Egypt. And essentially this leads us to, hold on. We'll get you the pasuk here. To HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling them, Vayomer Hashem, the pasuk Yod Aleph here, Ad Ana Yina Tsuni Ma'am Azeh. How long are they going to do this? Ad Ana Lo Ya'aminu Vi. They don't believe me. Chol ha'osos asher asisi b'kirbo, everything that I've done for them. So the question is, what in the world just happened? How did we go from almost entering into Israel until this total breakdown and this 180 of the people that went into the land of Israel, these Rashi b'nei Israel? So why is God so angry? So the easiest answer is that God is angry because simply they don't believe in God. They're saying, lo nuchal la'alos. God tells them from the beginning of time, everything that God has said has come true. Go down to Egypt, they went, or go down to a foreign land, they went down to a foreign land. I'll take you out, took them out, gave them the Torah. But all of a sudden, these people seem to feel like we don't necessarily want to go in. We don't believe God could do it. That's very, very hard to believe that these Rashi B'nai Israel, these leaders of the Jewish people, really doubted that God could do what he said he were going to do. So it's possible as well that, before we get into some of the more in-depth approaches, one other possibility, which is something to think about, is that they believed God could do it, but they loved Midbar life. Midbar life, desert life, was great. Not physically, which was great, but spiritually. I could see the fire that God sent out in front. I could see the cloud that God sent out. Anything I needed, every day when I got up, my clothes were exactly as I needed them. And that told me that God is watching out for me. Why would I want to leave such a place? it's so much comfortable here. It's so much better here. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets angry at them. That's not how the world works. The world doesn't work like that. The world works. They're going into Israel, settling the land, getting close to God on your own, and not when everything is so so easy in front of you. So that's number one. That's number two. Number one is maybe they didn't believe in God. Hard to believe. Number two is they'd rather stay in the desert. Number three, actually, is that a very fascinating opinion of Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, of the Lubliner, that the Jews, it wasn't they didn't have faith. How could they not have faith? They saw the plagues. They saw Kriyas Yamsuf. They saw Har Sinai. They saw Kabbalah Satorah. They saw the mountain. Now they're going to say we don't have faith. Come on. The answer is they had a faith, but they didn't have a certain kind of faith. There are two aspects to Emunah. When we did our Emunah series last 2 years ago in Shavuot, two Shavuos ago, we discussed this topic. Rabbeinu Bacha Ibn Pakuda in the 11th century notes that there are two parts having faith in God. One part is that God exists and God can do whatever he wants, however he wants, whenever he wants. The second part of faith, which is a little bit more difficult for us, is that God will do all of those things, but he'll do them for me. And in fact, at the Yam Suf, when the Jews say, Vayaminu Bahashem, the Rabbeinu Bachya says, the Chovas HaLevavos, right? It doesn't mean that now they had faith in God. It means now they realize that God will do things even just for them. So Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin says, the 10 spies didn't lack trust in God's capabilities, but they lacked a trust in themselves. That's why if you look at this pasuk, let's go back to this pasuk for a second. Hold on. It's a beautiful read of the pasuk. If you go back here to the end of Perek Yud Gimel, look at this. So the pasuk says, "V'sham ra'inu es ha'nefilim," pasuk of Lam Gimel. We saw the nefilim, the b'nei anak, b'nei anak, giants. Vani ve'einenu kechagavim. We were like grasshoppers. Now, what does that mean? It either means, yeah, they were really, really big, and we were really, really small. Okay? It's like, you know, when I was a senior in high school and I was 5'10", I had to play center. It didn't work out well. We got beat by a lot of points almost every game. Okay? We were like grasshoppers. The Rebbe Tzadok says they viewed themselves as grasshoppers. Who are we? We're nobodies. We're no one. We're like, we don't view ourselves with enough trust and confidence. And when the spies say, Ki chazak hu mimenu, they're not talking about God's ability to conquer the land. Right? They doubted his ability to conquer it for them. Who are we? We're not so righteous. If we were more righteous, then we know God could take care of it for us. But we view ourselves as grasshoppers. So if we view ourselves as grasshoppers, for sure, God views us as grasshoppers. So why would God do any of these things for us? And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tzadok HaKohen says it was a lack of emunah in themselves. We, in our own eyes, we were like grasshoppers. The other, so that's three approaches. Number one, they didn't believe in God, which it seems from the psukim. Number two is that they rather have the life of the desert. And number three is they didn't believe enough in themselves. Okay? Now, the other aspect to this discussion is that we're talking here about a role of leadership. Okay, what do I mean about a role of leadership? If you go to the psukim, this dibasa aretz, slander. What does that mean, slander? We're going to see that they were encouraging they were utilizing politics to create fear in their camp. These were the leaders. And take your own politics and, insert wherever you want here. They used their role in the opposite way. They should have used their role of leadership to make a buy-in. Moshe thinks they're going to buy in. Why else would he have them report? Right? If you're an administrator in any business or in any school, and you have somebody come in to give you an assessment, you don't say, you know what? You show your assessment in front of the board and the parent body without me looking at it first. That's the worst idea in the world. Because let's say it doesn't come out the way you thought. So you want it first. Moshe for sure thinks they're going to come back So therefore, Moshe says, when you come back to me and to Aaron, Machol, Adas, Bnei Yisrael, and we'll like be even more motivated than what happens. And that leads us to understand the role of Kalev and the role of Yehoshua. So let's go back for a second. Hold on, one second. So before we go, let's understand one thing about Kalev and Yehoshua. When we go to the response of Kalev and Yehoshua, you'll notice that it's really Kalev who says something. Yehoshua stays silent, but Kalev says something. Vayas, he just silences them. Now, they gave a list. They're giants, they're big, they're this and they're that. It seemed that the smarter approach would have been if one guy got up there and said, these are the reasons we can't go in, all right. So Kalev gets up and Kalev says, here are the reasons that we should go in, right? We ever have any kind of debate, not like fake presidential, but like real debates when people are actually arguing things and they have a side. You know, in class sometimes when we do Dine Mamonis cases, like in monetary law, I make a Beis Din in class and I make the students, there's a Beis Din and they have to get up and they have to argue their case. And they could counter with whatever somebody gave against them. So the spies, 10 of them, give reasons. They're too big, they're too small, whatever it is. So Kalev should have said, no. We have this weapon and we have that weapon. What's Vayas Kalev? And all Kalev says is, alo na'ale, right? Alo na'ale, we could do it. So I'll share with you an amazing idea, which we probably shared before, but it's worth repeating, especially, I think, during the time period in which we find ourselves. The great Esh Kodesh, Rav Kleinim is Kalman Shapiro, was the Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto. The Esh Kodesh was born in the late 19th century, 1889. He was a descendant of some of the most famous masters of Hasidus, Elimelech of Lezhensk, Chozemi Lublin, Magd of Koznitz. His father, the Esh Kodesh's father, passes away when he's 3 years old. And the war, eventually, we'll skip out a little bit, although there's much more to talk about. When the war breaks out, when the Holocaust breaks out, those that were closest with him insisted that he leave Warsaw for a safer location. And he writes in the Esh Kodesh, I'm not going to desert my Hasidim during this time. Wherever they are, that's where I must be. As a side note, just if you study a little bit about the Holocaust and Hasidish Rebbes, different Hasidim wanted to get their Rebbes out. Many Rebbes didn't want to, but for the Hasidim, this was our legacy. We're not going to survive, but if we can get you out and you survive, we are living on through you. But he says, I'm not leaving my Hasidim. Before the war, he already had lost his wife, and he had his only son of Elimelech Shapira. His home in the Warsaw Ghetto became a hub for people seeking spirituality. And during a bombing in 1939, shrapnel flies in, strikes himself and his son. As bombs are falling, he's running around to find a help for his son. At one point, he goes to ask a doctor to come to the hospital. A mile away, a bomb falls and it kills, unfortunately, his daughter-in-law and his sister-in-law. He builds a little sukkah. He builds a sukkah. Unfortunately, his son, he has so many losses. And the Yiddish newspaper, and we have to get back to the parsha, but the Esh Kodesh is a hero. The Yiddish newspaper, the foreword in 1940 writes, this is an accurate reading, from 1940 in the Yiddish newspaper, it says, the Piazechta Rebbe lost in the period of a few days his only son, his mother, his daughter-in-law, and his sister-in-law. There was no one else to say Kaddish for those who died. The Rebbe himself is not reciting Kaddish for them all, as he is for his wife, who died shortly before the war. But then it writes, the stricken Rebbe is not broken in morale or spirit. He's remained in Warsaw. He's conducting Tishin with his Hasidim, learned Torah throughout the day, and is writing a book. The Piagets of Hasidim marvel at the remarkable self-control of their Rebbe. That is the Esh Kodesh. The Esh Kodesh, during one of the most difficult times in Jewish history, didn't just teach Torah. He lifted up their morale. He taught Torah. He gave Musar. And unlike many of the works written post the Shoah, Esh Kodesh is written mamish from the depths of the Holocaust, 1939 to 1942. And he says the following about Kalev. He says, Alo na'ale. What's this Alo na'ale? So what's Kolev's answer? So Rashi suggests that the sin of the spies was that they even asked for the spies. Look what God had done for you, redeemed you out of slavery, given you all of this chutzpah. But the Ramban says the asking for spies wasn't a problem, right? The sin of the spies was that it was supposed to be really a military mission, and it sort of went haywire. And it went haywire, and they took matters into their own hands. So in comes Kalev. In June 22nd, 1940, the Eish Kodesh gives a drasha in which he addresses this response of Kalev. And he says, yes, Kalev was right. The people in the land of Israel, they're giants. They are fortified. They could eat their inhabitants. Eretz, Ocheles, everything you said, I'm in agreement with. But luckily, we're not asked to go about this alone. What we are asked to do is trust in God. Kalev didn't counter with all these arguments because it wasn't about that. Instead, he summoned them about Emunah, alone na'ale. We just have to do it. And Rav Shapiro writes, this is the faith that's required of a Jew. Even when we don't see any logical or natural avenue for salvation, we must believe that God, who is above the limits of nature, will save us. Alo na'ale was on the lips of Jews throughout Jewish history. Sometimes it seems insurmountable, and it seems difficult, and it seems wildly, crazy to think about salvation when enemies and persecutions and pogroms and viruses and pandemics are ravaging the nation and the world. The response of Alo na'ale is that we trust in God. And just today, just this afternoon, I had a conversation with a former student of mine who really was struggling with some of these issues about faith. Why is this happening? Why could all of these things be? And it's difficult to have emunah during times like this. And I said, 1,000%. Yet, it is easy to have emunah when things are good, right? We know that. And when things are difficult and we don't have answers, that's when we struggle. And Kalev is saying, I know that. I get it. And alone, Allah. We are not asked about to go about this alone. We are asked to go about this with connection with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's the response of Kalev. That's why he doesn't give a long-winded answer to anything else. He simply wants to just provide them with the emunah that they need. And maybe that's why the Jews aren't really ready. The Jews, this was not like a sin. This was more than just a sin. This was, as we learned last week, this was building up. This had existed for a while. They need time to re-educate themselves, to get a whole nother nation that when it's finally brought into Israel, has learned and has spent time with the Mon and with God, and that nation can get into Israel. But this nation isn't really yet ready. But let me just end with talking about what this means, Dibas, this Lashon Hara aspect. It's very much a topic that's a hot button issue today. The topic of free speech, right? Free speech. That's one of the biggest topics today is what we can say. The First Amendment, right? The relevant part to this discussion is that Congress, right? Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. And from college campuses to Twitter and all of these issues, free speech is a really an issue. It's a big problem. What you can say, what you can't say. And there are obviously exceptions to the concept of the freedom of speech. So what exactly was the Lashon Hara? Right? Why where was the freedom of speech for the Meraglim? They went in, they saw the stuff, they came back, they said, here's what we saw. Why is that so bad? Why was that so terrible? They didn't make stuff up. They didn't say, oh my gosh, you should have seen it. They had like booby traps, and then there was this thing and that thing, and they made, all right, they reported back what they saw. So Why was this such a terrible sin? The Meraglim seemed to have a right to share their view. Why else were they sent? So Rashi says, no, Rashi says, the first Rashi, Shlach Lecha Anoshim, that the Meraglim, this week's Parsha, and last week's Parsha of Miriam are next to each other. They're neighbors, as my cousin says. L'vishalaksa al iske diba. They should have taken a lesson. They spoke Lashon Hara, just like Miriam had done. They didn't learn their lesson. How is there Lashon Hara about a land, about a field? the field's going to feel bad. The land of Israel is going to like, is going to cry. So maybe you could argue, maybe Israel has feelings. If you ever make fun of some building, look at that architecture. You don't sit there apologizing to it. If you did, that would be strange. It would look weird. So what this means is shares with us another aspect of Lashon Hara. Right? Lashon Hara is always a good topic to talk about because it's always very, very relevant. But the aspect here about Lashon Hara is that there is something that when we speak bad about other people, we influence the way that they think about that person. Right? I don't have the time. We're running out of time already. But to discuss some of these cases in which they showed people images in front of their eyes, and then they showed a negative connotation quickly to that image, they thought badly about whatever passed in front of them. When we speak Lashon Hara, it influences those around us. Like the Rambam says, we know, Lashon Hara affects three people, right? So the guy that says it, of course that's Lashon Hara, because he's spreading it, he's the one who's sharing it, he's the one who's could be making stuff up, that's bad. The guy who hears it, also bad. He heard Lashon Hara, he accepted it. Okay, what about the third guy? The third guy who had spoken about that, he didn't get a sin, but it affects him because now there's another person in the world that thinks negatively about this guy. And that's what happened when the Meraglim come back and the Meraglim share this view, even if it was accurate, but they also share a little bit of their own flavor. FS Kiyasa, but I don't think so. It's going to be too difficult. Lo nucha lalos. What's lo nucha? Who are you to say lo nucha lalos? You want to come back and say, there's fortresses, there's this and there's that. And Moshe would have said, yes, here's how we're going to do it. But when they share their viewpoint, and they, you know, sometimes we, I'm not saying you, but sometimes we share our own agenda. We color things the way we want it, or we tell a story over in a way that it fits how we want it to be told over. We spin it the way we want to spin it. That's what the world of media is today. It's all about spinning it. It's about sound bites. And if I could take one sound bite out from your speech, I have now, that's what all media is today in terms of, take for example, the election period. All ads that you see are mostly sound bites to influence you to think one way about a candidate. Right? If you hear this clip, now you will associate candidate X with this kind of thing, and that's a bad social approach. We want to Lashon Hara's goal is to bring people up. There's a famous writer, Napoleon Hill. Napoleon Hill was a young journalist. He wrote a book in the 1930s called "Think and Grow Rich." Okay, sold more than 100 million copies. And he introduced his steps having a million-dollar personality. It's what he called it. And he stole, you know, he says he from Charles Schwab's demeanor and all these different people that he culled his sources from. But in his 14 habits of how to be successful, the first one is to have a positive mental attitude, but to let it be seen by others. And that's the issue of the Meraglim. The Meraglim might have thought they were reporting facts, but in the way they reported it, it influenced those people around them. Lashon Hara is not only when I make up gossip about you. Lashon Hara is not only when you hear about this guy, I shared a rumor. Lashon Hara is when I speak bad about anybody and I influence the way that they think about that person. So we have to be very careful in what we share and how we share it, in the way that it's, in the tone that it's being shared with. And if I share a story in a way that the person listening to me takes in a negative way, that's on me. And if that guy shares with five more people, that's five more people. Lashon Hara is the one sin that you can't fix. The one sin you can't fix. Because how are you ever in the world going to find everyone that shared your negative viewpoint? So that's the Lashon Hara of the Meraglim. So yes, you can say Lashon Hara about a land in the way that you influence how people think about something. And that's sort of the whole story about the Meraglim. That when we peel it back a little bit, the story of the Meraglim is really a story about the faith we should have in ourselves. We should view ourselves with enough goodness and confidence that God will do these things for me. That I'm not be'enenu k'chagavim. I'm not a grasshopper. I'm a person that God very much cares about. Right? And if I view myself in that way and I'm confident about myself, I will want others to feel confident about themselves. I will socially influence people to the positive. If I don't view myself positively, I will bring others down with me, and that's why they come back. Maybe because they didn't view themselves positively, they didn't want to bring everybody else in. If we don't view ourselves positively, for sure you're not going to view yourselves positively. So the story of the Meraglim is really a story about self-worth, self-confidence, and not just in our morale, but in our spirituality, that I am enough for God to do these things for. It's what tshuva is based on. Right? Tshuva is based on the fact that God will do whatever he can and he'll do it for me. So when we look at it that way, I think it shares it in a new light about the faith, the emunah we should have in God, but really the emunah we should have in ourselves. Everybody should have a